Welcome to Outspoken Voices, a podcast by and for LGBTQ+ families anywhere on their journey. I'm your host, Emily McGranahan. I'm the Director of Family Engagement with Family Equality.
All right, folks, it's time. With over 30 episodes under my belt, it's time we talk about the education system. It touches all of our families around the world in very different ways. We've mentioned school in past episodes, but this one we are dedicating to the ups and downs, the challenges and inspiration of pushing for LGBTQ+ inclusive policies and practices in schools. We're focusing on elementary and early education this time, which means most advice is really geared towards adults in our families, but queer spawn in school and out of it also have voices and a really important role to play in advocacy in the education system. So with me to help me sift through all of these pieces are Justine Gonzalez and Caitlin Ryan. Justine is an LGBTQ advocate and community engagement specialist and recently served as president of the City of Los Angeles Human Relations Commission. Justine studied political science at California State University, Northridge, and gender, ethnicity, and multicultural studies at Pasadena City College. She has lived in Los Angeles for 15 years and currently resides in the neighborhood of Echo Park with her daughter. Caitlin L. Ryan is an associate professor in the Watson College of Education at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She holds a BA in Linguistics and African American Studies from the University of Virginia and an MA and PhD in Teaching and Learning from The Ohio State University. Before arriving at UNSCW, she taught K-5 literacy enrichment programs in Washington, D.C. and literacy education courses at East Carolina University. She is the co-author, along with Dr. Jill Herman Wilmarth of Western Michigan University, of the book Reading the Rainbow, LGBTQ Inclusive Literacy Instruction in the Elementary Classroom. So welcome, Justine and Caitlin.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, I want to start with the question we start every episode off with. Who is in your family and how was it formed? Justine, would you start us off?
Sure. It's a, you know, complicated situation. So my family, primarily it's me and my daughter. She just turned 6 years old just a few weeks ago and just started kindergarten. So that's really exciting. Me and my co-parent have separated. So we have sort of an extended family. And luckily, you know, we're still good friends and she lives nearby. So my daughter is my biological child. You know, me and my co-parent are both queer, and we decided to have a biological child together.
And Caitlin, who is in your family and how was it formed?
In my family of origin, it was my mom, my dad, my brother, and me. But currently, my family is me and my wife, and we have just started foster parenting within the last few months, actually. So we are new to parenting, and we are very excited. And we currently have a wonderful kiddo with us, and we're having a great time. He's currently just turned 17 months old today.
I read a little bit of your bios, and you both have different family experiences, different professional experiences. So how would you describe your relationship with the education system, and how, when, why do you advocate for LGBTQ families in school? Sort of what is your role in this particular conversation?
Yeah. So like I said, Cecilia, the idea of where she was going to school was always sort of in the background. How are we going to do this? Me coming out as transgender happened when Cecilia was 1 year old. And she was a big part of that decision for me to come out because I didn't want to, you know, have a future where I was her dad. And I thought that I could move up my transition, get it done in a way that, you know, I could just be Cecilia's mama and it could be clean cut and, you know, we'll move forward from there. But it turns out transitions don't happen that way anyway. You can't really force them to happen a certain way. So lessons learned there, but also, so now we look at, you know, as she approached, she spent a full year in transitional kindergarten already. And it was really concerning about how would teachers react? How would other students react, other parents? And so as that time approached over the years, you have the general anxiety of like what this is like, what this is going to be like, what challenges would my daughter face? in this, you know, and to think a 4, 5, 6 year old has to even navigate this space was scary. So there was a bit of, you know, fundamentally, there's just that personal experience of being in it. And so it was kind of like, it was sort of overwhelming, sort of like, I don't know how any of this is going to play out, but LAUSD, where we live in LA Unified School District, and California has some of the strongest policies on paper in terms of sort of inclusivity. From my experience in working in the nonprofit sector and in local government over almost 10 years, was that having policies on paper is very different from the lived experiences and encounters that, you know, LGBTQ families, among so many other groups of students and families, what are the real resources there and how do we navigate them? So there was the personal journey. There was sort of the, you know, my professional career sort of informed me of like, hey, you need to be prepared to be an advocate like so many other parents have to be. So right now my role, I'm a consultant still, but working specifically with nonprofits around building parent communities and building parent workshops to give parents the tools to, you know, one, support their children, and then two, navigate the district in a way that, you know, when they need to, they can, you know, access the right channels and resources to get the support they need from staff and administrators.
Wow, that's fantastic to have those kind of two sides of parent and then also really supporting others, improving the system. That's awesome. And Caitlin, how would you describe your relationship with the education system and your role within advocacy?
One thing I like to remind the teachers that I work with is that all LGBTQ people, adults, were actually kids. And so I think it's important when we think about this topic to remember that I was a student and I was a student. So, I was a queer person who was in schools for a very long time. But since then, I have been a teacher. I taught, like you said in my bio, in the Washington, D.C. public schools. And I am now a teacher educator. So I train current and future elementary school teachers, particularly in helping kids learn how to read and become lifelong readers. Also in that capacity, I'm a researcher and I study how to help K-5 teachers in particular, but all teachers become more LGBTQ inclusive in their teaching. So I feel like in some ways I have all the sides of it. I was a student, I was a teacher, I'm training teachers. And like you said, now I'm also a parent who will have kids eventually in schools as they get older. So, and like you said, most of the work that I do in terms of research around LGBTQ inclusive teaching, I do with my longtime research and writing partner, Dr. Jill Herman Wilmarth. And so we've been kind of working on this for a while to try to make sure that teachers and other people in schools have some tools for how they can be better advocates and make their practice more inclusive so that families don't have to do quite so much work, right? Sort of meet in the middle, as it were.
And what inspired you to have that particular focus and to be doing that particular type of research?
Yeah. I mean, I think in general, my own queer identity, right? I identify as a lesbian and as queer. And so I knew that schools could be better. I knew that both, you know, individually and then also collectively as a community, I knew that people's experiences with schools weren't great. As part of that, I also have been connected to Collage, which is obviously, as you know, part of Family Equality Council now. And I've been connected to Collage for a long time, even though I'm not a Collager or a queer spun myself. I knew some of the very early founders of that work, including Hope Barry Manley, and who's a very, very good friend of mine. And so I have been thinking about queer spawn experiences for a long time and ended up actually writing my dissertation on the experiences of young queer spawn in schools. And that led me to think about, well, what could we as adults in schools, whether that be parents, administrators, or teachers, how could we take on some of that work so that it doesn't have to land on Collagers and queer spawn?
How do LGBTQ plus families, both parents and youth themselves, how do we advocate for safe and inclusive schools for our families? You've each mentioned a few different ways. Justine, you had talked about those sort of larger scale policies that will explicitly state LGBTQ people and families need to be, you know, celebrated and recognized and affirmed in school. So that's sort of there's a policy level. There's the practicalities, as you've both done, of training staff, you know, updating forms, using the inclusive language around the school. There's the in-classroom experience, which again is a different level, and sometimes there continues to be disconnect between those three. And then there's those peer experiences and thinking about the welcoming of our youth in schools and the preventing of and addressing of bullying. So there's a lot, you know, there.
There's so many different ways. There's not one answer. There's not one, you know, these are the three categories that we need to hit. You know, when I think about this and my current involvement, I sort of bring sort of the organizing and field work aspect and campaign aspect to it, to the same sort of arena for parents, where I go, you know, first and foremost, on issues like this that are really, that they're really powerful, personal, intimate issues, I think you need to build physical spaces where people consistently communicate and talk. I think you need to have sort of that entry level space of like, where am I safe to talk about these things? Where can I build the skills to build inclusive environments? Because I think sort of how my work has been steered here is because parents on a regular basis reach out to me and they're like, hey, I think my child is LGBTQ and wants to transition or wants to come out. How do I support them? You know, it's easy to find a web page and handouts and booklets and online resources. But I think for most parents, you know, looking at something like that and then turning that into an action with your child, you know, it's a scary thing that I think from a good place, a lot of parents don't want to get it wrong. So there's very much a desire to like, hey, I know I'm just a parent. I'm a parent. I'm not a teacher, but I want some of those skills. Like, can someone just sit down with me and talk to me about this? When we talk about like LA Unified School District, it's a school district with 600,000 students covering millions of people overall, and trying to find the right resources to get as many of those families on board is difficult because from a budgeting perspective, from a district perspective. So I find myself sort of organizing and going like, where are the gaps?
It's interesting, Justine. I'm really struck by how your description of parents and organizing parents and sort of limited knowledge and wanting resources and wanting help translating resources to practice rings so true for my work with teachers. And I want to echo what you said, but again, about a teacher perspective is that, you know, Jill and I find over and over that teachers really often want to be supportive. Now, there are unfortunately still cases where there is explicit outright homophobia and transphobia expressed by teachers. You know, GLSEN has some unfortunate documented statistics about things that students hear and families hear from educators themselves. And that's really, I mean, to say it's a shame is putting it mildly. But we also find there are many, many, many teachers who in fact do want to be supportive of LGBTQ people and families, but they either don't know how or they don't think they know how. So there's still a lot of questions around, okay, well, how do I do it? What can I do in my state? What do the laws say I can do? What does my district say I can do? And so trying to make sure that people know that they can advocate and, as teachers, and that they can make their classrooms more inclusive. And in fact, that it's a responsibility of educators to serve every child and to serve every family. And, you know, you talked before about the gap between some of those policies that, you know, if your district says that you're going to educate every child or that you're going to work with families as partners in students' education, then that has to mean LGBTQ people and that has to mean LGBTQ families as well. And just sort of helping them see the sources of support that they do have, it's just has become really important. And so the other thing I would encourage when we're thinking about parents is, and this is hard because I know for many LGBTQ parents, there's a lot of vulnerability in this and not everyone can be out or can be safe in these kinds of advocacy. But for LGBTQ parents who can be vocal, the more visible that queer folks are as parents and as family members really helps to change the discourse. Because the number one thing that Jill and I hear from teachers is, but what about the parents? I mean, we've been doing this for like 12, 15 years now, I think. I don't know the exact number. And every time we talk to a class, we talk to a school, we talk to a district, the first question every time is, well, what about the parents? And what they mean by parents is, what about the conservative parents? What about the religious right parents? What about parents who object? And one thing that Jill is really good about saying, Jill has two children and is queer. And she says, well, I'm a parent. And trust me, you don't want to not do this stuff if my kid's in your class, because I will come in there and you do not want that. And I was like, no, you really don't want that. So, you know, so how can we shift that narrative of who parents are, and to think about that there are, in fact, many parents, queer and allied parents, who do want school to be LGBTQ inclusive and who do want a reduced
focus on gender binary in elementary education and who do want classrooms to be more inclusive for more learners, particularly for queer learners. And the more that we can start to think, you know, parents want that too, I think teachers will feel a lot more, I don't know, security maybe, or just a lot more confidence in undertaking some of those things that really are, can still be risks in a lot of places.
Yeah, and that totally makes sense. When we talk about students, and teachers and administrators as the other, and then parents as the other, I think we all need to realize that all three need the tools. There's not really a way to do it one at a time. And I see it here locally in Los Angeles, where it's like there's so many resources for LGBTQ youth to be loud and to create those spaces, which is amazing. I accessed those services as a youth when I came out. But what there aren't, you know, there's just a gap in that availability between students and then administrators, teachers, and parents. Like you said, there's so much desire. There's just a sort of lack of capacity in terms of the real funding needed, the real resources needed by schools, by districts, by parents to really get on the same page. I mean, all of these groups need to work together. And like you said, there are people, there are teachers, administrators, parents already doing good work, and yes, parents, and all of these people who want to do more good work and want to be on the same page and supportive.
And I think in addition to the structural things that you named in terms of resources, sometimes I also come up, especially in elementary education, with just limitations of what feels possible, like sort of what people have thought through, particularly straight people. The teaching force, I don't know if the numbers are true in LA Unified, it might be different, but you know, nationally, our teaching force is overwhelmingly white, female, middle class, Christian, able-bodied, and straight, right? Just overwhelmingly. And so a lot of times teachers just haven't thought about, teachers who fall into those identity categories, haven't thought about their privilege in those particular ways. They haven't thought about what other needs people from more marginalized communities might have with intersectional identities and other kinds of topics. They just haven't thought about it. And so they don't have a sense of what it could sound like. Sometimes it's like a failure of imagination almost, in addition to some of the structural issues that you mentioned. And so just helping people think through how education could sound, because unfortunately, I think for teachers and for us as parents, we haven't actually seen schools where queerness has been affirmed very much. Like that is kind of a new thing, at least at the national system-wide level. I mean, I remember when I was working with a teacher I worked with for a long time, and she was reading a chapter book with an openly gay middle schooler in it to her fourth and fifth grade students. And I remember the first time she came across a derogatory slur for gay people in the book. And I realized, like, I had never been in a classroom space where that word was said in an educational way to talk about it and to take the power out of it. And that here were elementary school students doing this work that I do for my job. I mean, this is what I, you know, professionally, I'm supposed to be the expert on this. And I realized, like, I'd never really heard this kind of conversation in a classroom before as a student, as a teacher, or as a researcher. And so it is new, and it's gonna feel new in different ways to different constituents and different people. And so giving ourselves some, you know, some grace and some space to build those kinds of new practices and that new picture, but also knowing that it's absolutely imperative that we get to it, because kids and kids' lives are at stake and families' safety is at stake.
Yeah. In this particular conversation right now that we're having, we're really, I think, focusing on elementary school. We're kind of talking about, like, you know, advocacy for that parents can do, just understanding that youth, to have some of the tools for them to be their own best advocates. It's so important for them to have adults in their lives who are able to do that with them and support them and help educate them. Do you get pushback or different responses based on the level, like that, where kids are in education and the types of schools?
Yeah, I would say absolutely in terms of age and grade level. There's also, I think, a lot of assumptions about where this work can happen geographically. I teach in the South, and I am in a mid-sized city now, but I was in a very rural area until just this fall. And so teaching teachers who were going to be teaching in very rural areas in the South, and there's definitely an assumption that, oh, this might be okay in other places, but like we couldn't do that here. And the thing is that I understand the fears, but there are kids and families here. So not being able to do something isn't really an answer. So one of the things that we like to say is, there might be a lot of things that you can't do, right? There might be risks that a teacher or a school can't take. There might be decisions that a school board would reject or, you know, or are against the laws, like with the no promo homo states. I mean, there are some limitations, unfortunately, still. But find what you can do. Instead of thinking about what you can't do, think about what you can do. And so if what you can do is, you know, put a safe space sticker up, but you can't read a book aloud. Okay, if you can read a book, you know, you can put a book on your shelf, but you can't read it aloud. Like, what is it that you can do? Or if you can just stop using boy and girl lines, right? Like, if you can just treat gender in a more, what my colleague Lee Ayrton calls gender-friendly way, right? Can you just expand what's possible and thinking about how we think about kids and the divisions between kids? You know, sort of find what you can do, because, yeah, there might be a lot that doesn't feel possible right now, but what are the ways that you can continue to push back on the system, even with young kids? Because that's the other thing, you know, how can you teach about families? Family is in every ELA and social studies standard in KM1. It's such a go-to topic for early childhood topics, right? And so, yeah, there's definitely places to talk about LGBTQ people. But that also means that teachers and administrators and other parents, particularly parents who aren't allies, have to understand that talking about LGBTQ people is not talking about sex, which in schools is still really a huge misconception. And so, you know, that we have to tell people that it's talking about connections and families and communities and love. And so I think if we, like, shifting to that is a good starting point sometimes too, particularly when you start to talk about early childhood, because so many of those myths unfortunately still circulate and do make it risky for queer educators and do make it risky for queer families. And so, yeah, thinking about what you can do and finding age-appropriate ways to talk about LGBTQ people.
That's so true. And both of you have brought this up, that it's not like, I mean, our families are everywhere. We know in recent studies, you know, that have been done by Movement Advancement Project or other, you know, research institutions, you know, we know that LGBTQ families are, you know, more likely to be in states that have broad laws that are not safe and affirming for our families. Youth who identify as LGBTQ are in elementary schools. People with LGBTQ parents are in classrooms and of all ages. And what, Justine, as you mentioned, like what our peers are saying to us, what we're observing in the classroom, what we're hearing from adults, doesn't suddenly turn on when we enter high school. It is something that meets us at the door that first day of pre-K.
Yeah. And so much of what both of you have said has resonated with me. I'm in Los Angeles, and you would think, like, Southern California, best laws on the books protecting folks. We have the Fair Education Act. You know, there's an incredible delay in implementation across the state. So there is no consistent implementation, no consistent enforcement. Even with, you know, in the region in Los Angeles, since it's such a sprawling city, when I talk to different parents in different schools, they go like, well, that could work in your neighborhood in Northeast Los Angeles, but what about the heavily Latino and immigrant community in Southeast Los Angeles? And, you know, it's really difficult to sort of hold that line of, like, one, we have to do it. Like, this is about kids' safety, health, wellness for the long term. This is the trajectory of their lives and how they are impacted. So there are incredible stakes to this and getting it done right. But also, too, I think in my experience, and I ran for school board late last year, and really sitting down with parents in that region and them going like, no, like, even monolingual Spanish speaking immigrant families going like, we tell our kids that they can be whatever they want to be. And like, you are embodying that in this thing. And it was one of the most powerful experiences professionally that I've ever had. You know, when we don't do the changes necessary, so many of those kids and their families fall through the cracks.
One thing I would encourage LGBTQ families who are listening to this to do is to really think about what safe and inclusive means for your family, because with the diversity of our families, that's going to look and sound different for different people. In my research with collagers in particular, the number of times I heard kids say, oh, well, she doesn't make a big deal about it, so it's fine. This idea that sort of like silence was somehow good enough, or like as good as could have been expected, given their experiences, that there was some sort of, well, as long as I wasn't being mocked or teased for my family, then it was okay. And thinking about the gap between that as acceptable versus being affirmed and fully included, it just feels like a really wide distance still. And so this idea, I think, and that a lot of teachers have, and I don't know if it comes out of a sort of politeness, like a fake politeness idea, that like, if we don't talk about it, then somehow that's polite. If we don't talk about it, then somehow that's good. Whereas like, no, I want you talking about all the parts of my kid's life. I want you talking about everything and talking about it in respectful, inclusive, thoughtful ways, just like you would talk about anybody else, and just not realizing how damaging that kind of silence can be. And what I found in my study is that the more that adults are willing to open up conversations, the more kids will fill the space. So I started to find this over and over. The more that an adult made some space to say, this topic is valid here, this part of you is welcome here, kids would hear that and kids would take up that space. And I just think that that's really important for us to remember as parents and as teachers and as organizers and as administrators, is that if there's a silence, it's probably because you're sending some kind of message that you're expecting it. And so the more that adults can take on the role to say, no, this identity is valid, this kind of family is a family, this kind of whatever those things are, then kids will hear that message and then kids will feel more free to make a wider range of choices for themselves.
Absolutely. What can people look for to help them determine or decipher how safe and inclusive a school or a classroom is?
I think it's all about communication. I think it's, you know, it starts when you go on a tour of a school, when you're researching and you call and you set up that first meeting. Just being upfront about your concerns, I think, is very important. Saying like, this is our family. And I remember having that first conversation at Cecilia's transitional kindergarten and going like, do you have other families like ours? Have you ever worked with families like ours before? Like, what's your experience? And get like a real sense of like, would they know what to talk about? Would they know how to talk about it? Do they need resources too? And just getting on the same page. And it's a learning experience. I don't think there were some bumps along the road, but I always felt that our teachers and administrators, you know, we're open to it as long as we had an honest conversation.
Yes. Caitlin, and any other advice for anybody who's trying to make some of those determinations of the environment of a particular school?
Yeah, I think particularly maybe I'll say for people who might not have a lot of choice in the schools their children attend, if you're just trying to get a sense of how you might keep your family safe, one thing you might do is check the shelves. Do they have books with LGBT families or LGBT people on the shelves? Like, that can be a place if you're not comfortable having some of the more direct conversations that Justine was mentioning, that would be, you know, also a really great way to do things. But if you're looking for other signs, right, what's on their bookshelves? You could also see how they respond to requests. So like, if you said like, oh, you know, has anyone ever asked for this form to say parent one, parent two, like sort of just see what people, if they say like, no, why would we do that? That's good information. You could see what happens if parents have ever challenged books before, right? Has anyone ever said that something that you were teaching or a teacher was teaching wasn't okay, and what happened, right? So just sort of get some more information. How does the school talk about marginalized people generally, right? So what are conversations like around race? What are conversations like around immigration? What are conversations like around other kinds of identities and power, which might give you a sense to either for your family specifically, if those are identities that interface with your family, but also more generally about their sort of openness to a range of identities and a range of people.
Thank you. Those were really, really helpful. And any final thoughts?
I think that I would just encourage all the LGBTQ families out there listening to just in general be advocates for education, be advocates for public education. Because of the diversity of our families, thing that affects kids and communities affect our kids and communities, right? Whether that's class sizes, whether that's over policing and school to prison pipeline issues, all of those big education issues affect our kids in queer families. So, you know, all the things that affect kids in education affect our kids. And so just standing up for educators and making voting decisions and funding decisions that support teachers and support schools so that people can have more spaces, better spaces, safer spaces, more inclusive spaces. And if teachers need any resources, give them Jill's in my book. There's lots of other great ones too.
I don't think I have anything really major to add other than that. I think public schools, and they need to be funded. We need to give the teachers the resources they need and really push ahead as partners, whether we're parents, youth, teachers, administrators, and work together, because that's the only way we're going to get to fully inclusive schools that respect that intersectionality between race, gender, class, you know, LGBTQ plus families. The only way we get there is if we're working together.
So yeah, thank you both so much. And we will link on the website to more information about Caitlin and Jill's book, Reading the Rainbow, LGBTQ Inclusive Literacy Instruction in the Elementary Classroom. And also some really awesome writings and interviews with Justine as well will be on the website. Thank you both for taking the time to talk with us.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
If you enjoy Outspoken Voices, there's another podcast I'd like to recommend, especially for current and future parents. Is It Bedtime Yet? There are some great episodes focusing on the unique experiences of LGBTQ plus parenthood and lots of general parenting ideas and commiseration. So check out Is It Bedtime Yet?
Welcome to Is It Bedtime Yet? Hosted by Dr. Jen and Dr. Serene, the podcast about mental health and the experience of being a parent.
As therapists and moms, we understand how hard and challenging parenting can be, and we wanted to create a space for parents that's authentic and validating with a touch of humor. Join us as we explore topics from postpartum depression to mom shaming and everything in between.
Join us and our guests as we explore what it's like being adults raising tiny humans that make us all ask, "Is it bedtime yet?"
Subscribe to Is It Bedtime Yet podcast so you don't miss any episodes. You can find our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Again, thank you for joining us today. Please rate, review, and subscribe to Outspoken Voices. It really helps others find the show. You can listen to Outspoken Voices on our website, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast app. You can find Family Equality at familyequality.org and on Facebook and Instagram at Family Equality and on Twitter at family_equality. For questions, inquiries, or episode suggestions, contact us at outspokenvoices@familyequality.org. And remember that love, justice, and equality is what brings our families together.